IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
One of the greatest scholars of our time was Shaheed Murtaza Mutahiri. He actually has a book known as Sayri Dar Nahj al-Balagha in Farsi, where he has selected different themes, and then he had studied Nahj al-Balagha based on the themes that he has selected. The style used by Shaheed Murtaza Mutahiri was such that it can be used by scholars as well as by the general audience. And so it is something I would recommend, you know, as a commitment you can make with Amir al-Mu'mineen, that at least I will think about studying the Nahj al-Balagha. If the entire book looks very bulky and heavy, maybe go through this book, where you have different themes, select the one which is of your interest, and then get closer to the ideas and the values of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam. Recently, another scholar from the West, Dr. Raza Shah Kazemi, came up with a book entitled as Justice and Remembrance, where he talks about two themes from Amir al-Mu'mineen, focusing on Nahj al-Balagha, on the issue of justice and the issue of remembrance, means zikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the issue of, you know, righteousness. Of course, this is more a serious work. So those who are interested in serious reading, that book also would be a good source to study about the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen on these three themes, the issue of adl and justice and the issue of taqwa and righteousness and zikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Let us go to Ali. The second khutbah in Nahj al-Balagha is a long khutbah, but there is one part towards the end where Ali talks about the status of Ahlul Bayt. And of course, he is the head of Ahlul Bayt. They are the Ahlul Bayt of Rasul. And the way he talks about it is very important, because unfortunately we hear time and again that, oh, Shias are ghali, they exaggerate the position of Ali and Ali Ali. Well, this is not a marja, this is not an alim, this is not a khatib, this is Ali himself. You know, the way he talks about Ahlul Bayt, let me briefly, you know, present that here. He begins by saying, hum mawdu'u sirrihi ولجوا أمره وعيبة علمه ومعلل حكمه وكهوف كتبه وجبال دينه. He says, Ahlul Bayt, the Ali Muhammad, they are the trustees of the secrets of Rasulullah. You know, the word secretary technically means the assistant who keeps your, you know, confidential documents. And so here, Ali is saying, as far as the confidential documents and issues of Rasulullah, we Ahlul Bayt are the trustee of that. Shelter of his affairs, containers of his knowledge, refuge for his commands, caves for his books, and mountains of his religion. What does he mean by all this? Mawdi' as-sirrihi, if you really want to know what was the true perspective of Rasulullah on any issue, don't go here and there. Go to Ahlul Bayt.
Dear
listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Over the past few weeks, Russia has amassed nearly 100,000 troops on Ukraine's border. The Pentagon suggests Moscow is planning a false flag operation in Ukraine as a pretext for invasion.
Without getting into too much detail, we do have information that indicates that Russia is already working actively to create a pretext for a potential invasion. For a move on Ukraine. In fact, we have information that they pre-positioned a group of operatives to conduct what we call a false flag operation, an operation designed to look like an attack on them or their people or Russian-speaking people in Ukraine. Again, as an excuse to go in.
A White House task force that includes the CIA is reportedly mulling over U.S. support for a guerrilla war in case Russia takes Ukraine. And Britain has sent military aid, including anti-tank weapons, to Ukraine. Kiev says it will defend itself from a potential attack carried out by Russia. Earlier in January, Washington reportedly sent secret shipments to Ukraine, enacting a previous decision to provide an additional $200 million in military aid. Now the U.S. President Joe Biden is threatening Russia with severe sanctions.
Well, let me start by first saying a few words about Russia and Ukraine. I've been absolutely clear with President Putin. He has no misunderstanding. If any assembled Russian units move across the Ukrainian border, that is an invasion. But it will be met with severe and coordinated economic response that I've discussed in detail with our allies, as well as laid out very clearly for President Putin. But there is no doubt, let there be no doubt at all, that if Putin makes this choice, Russia will pay a heavy price.
Moscow, however, continues to insist it has no intention to use force against Kiev. Back in December, the Russian president made it clear that his country was not after a war with its neighbor, but demanded pledges from the West, including a promise not to conduct NATO military activity in Eastern Europe. In December, Russia issued a set of proposals for enhancing collective security, which included guarantees that NATO would not expand further east and a particular agreement that no post-Soviet state, including Ukraine, should be permitted to join it. These demands were rejected by the US and its allies during a week of talks between officials from Russia, the US, NATO, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. State Department negotiator Wendy R. Sherman has dismissed it as a non-starter, declaring the United States will not allow anyone to slam closed NATO's open door policy. There is little doubt that Russia is able to crush Ukraine in an all-out conflict, given its air and naval superiority. But the question is how a war would benefit Russian national security. Russia says its security is threatened by Ukraine's growing ties with the Western alliance and the possibility of NATO missiles being deployed against it on Ukrainian territory. Moscow says it has grounds to believe Washington and NATO could start building up forces near Russia in the coming months, using the tensions around Ukraine as a pretext. Meanwhile, the Kremlin has blamed Kiev for failing to abide by the Minsk protocols, struck in 2014. The protocols meant to put an end to conflict in the nation's Donbas region, but have not come into effect. Russia says it is impossible to have good relations with the current Ukrainian government and that President Volodymyr Zelensky had come under the influence of radical forces. Russia believes it would be madness to start a war over Ukraine, but hasn't ruled out the possibility of taking counter-actions to NATO deployments if security negotiations fail and if its concerns go unheard. The West has made a lot of noises about the current developments over the Russia-Ukraine dispute, but in the worst-case scenario, it's not expected to do much. Over the past decade, the White House has shown it has no national interest sufficient to commit US troops to defend Ukraine against invasion. And as for NATO, the alliance is unlikely to admit Ukraine in the end, as its own agreements prohibit admission of any country with a disputed border. All in all, it's better for all sides to give diplomacy a chance for settling disputes, what Russia has been insisting on and the West has been ignoring. Allah, Allah,
Allah, Allah. این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah.
Question: What changes do you feel are needed regarding the position of women in Iranian society? How, in your opinion, will an Islamic government change the status of women, for example, as regards employment in the civil service and working in different professions such as medicine and engineering, and in other areas such as divorce, abortion, the right to travel, and compulsory wearing of the chador, the veil, hijab? Imam Khomeini replied, The Shah's malicious propaganda, along with that of people, bought with his money, has obscured the issue of women's freedom for the people so that they think Islam has come just to make women stay at home. Why should we oppose women's education? Why should we oppose them working? Why shouldn't women be able to work in the civil service? Why should we oppose women being able to travel? Women, like men, are free in all these things.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. We are talking about the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the search of Islam In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has mentioned that we want to make an Islamic and not a Western country. Now, this thing clearly tells us that the Islamic approach is different from the Western approach. And someone might say that, all right, we have many Islamic countries in the East, and why Imam has said the Western only? Because we do not see Islamic rules to be applied in those Eastern countries, which are the Muslim countries. The answer is basically, that's what Imam Khomeini wants to say. He wants to say that, look, even if you look at the Islamic countries, they do have the Western systems in their country. They are following the Western rules. They are following the Western way of running country in their countries. It's not Islamic. Therefore, Imam Khomeini is straightforward saying that we want an Islamic. There was a slogan even at the time of revolution. They said, we do not want to be neither the Western nor the Eastern. Rather, we want an Islamic country. So this was a main slogan at the time of revolution, which clearly shows that the East and West are following the same set of, rulership, or they have the same set of rules, which is based on the Western thinking. But Imam has said that we want the Islamic system. Why? Because it is Islam which takes you towards perfection. In the Western way of running country is that you need to benefit from what you have in either way you want, and there is no limitation on your benefits. In the socialism, we can see that they say no one can have any kind of ownership. But Islam has specific rules. It has divided the rules between the individuals and the government. So there is an equal or a just division. Therefore, when we look at the Islamic system, the political system, the economical system, the judicial system, we see a perfect set of rules and a perfect way of running a country.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Data on viral levels point to immune evasion as a cause of the variant's transmissibility, says Max Kozlov, writer, in an article titled, How Does Omicron Spread So Fast? A high viral load isn't the answer. Stay tuned for more. In countries around the world, Omicron has rapidly surged past other variants to become the dominant SARS-CoV-2 strain. Now, two studies show that the variant has achieved success despite causing viral levels in the body that are similar to or lower than those of its main competitor, the Delta variant. The results suggest that Omicron's hypertransmissibility does not stem from the release of large amounts of virus from infected people. Instead, the best explanation for its lightning fast spread is its ability to evade SARS-CoV-2 immunity caused by either vaccination or past infection, says Emily Bruce, a virologist at the University of Vermont in Burlington. The studies have not yet been peer-reviewed. Previous research has hinted that, compared with infection earlier in the pandemic, Delta variant infections lead to a higher viral load, the amount of virus in an infected person. This is often measured using a polymerase chain reaction, that is, PCR test, which provides an index of the quantity of viral RNA in a body. To compare the viral loads linked to the ever-changing cast of SARS-CoV-2 variants, Jonathan Gratt, an infectious disease specialist at the Harvard T.A. Chan School of Public Health in Boston, Massachusetts, and his co-authors drew on data from the National Basketball Association, the organization responsible for professional basketball in North America. The league conducts frequent COVID-19 testing of its players and personnel. The research has studied PCR test results of nose and throat swabs collected from infected individuals and found that those who had Delta had a slightly higher peak viral load than did those with Omicron. Gratt says, I was really not expecting to see that. After all, in only 2 months, Omicron replaced Delta as the dominant cause of U.S. COVID-19 cases. Mayer, a virologist at the University of Geneva in Switzerland, says he too was stunned by Gratt's results. He says, naturally, you'd think that higher transmissibility must cause a higher viral load. Mayer and his colleagues took the study a step further. Rather than measuring only viral RNA, they also measured the number of infectious virus particles on swabs collected from a separate group of almost 150 infected people. This more stringent method found no significant difference between the viral loads of vaccinated individuals infected with Omicron and those infected with Delta. The findings have implications for government policies on isolation after infection. Mayer's team examined samples from people who had been vaccinated but nonetheless became infected with Delta. They found that about half of the samples still held the infectious virus 5 days after the individuals tested positive. Gratt Grant and his colleagues found that 5 days after an initial positive test for Omicron, about half of tested individuals had viral loads high enough that they were probably still infectious. Such results are concerning, Grant says, because guidelines published by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, allow people infected with the virus to end their isolation 5 days after either testing positive or experiencing their first symptoms. The guidelines specify that people who have exited isolation must continue to wear a mask around others for 5 more days, but do not require a negative COVID-19 test to end isolation. The CDC did not respond to Nature with any comment by press time. Omicron has made public health decisions all the more difficult, Grant says. He and his colleagues also found more variability in viral load in individuals infected with Omicron than in people infected with Delta. He says that means there is no clear one-size-fits-all approach.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Before we deal with the law of miscellaneous nature, which is the topic today, and inshallah in the upcoming episodes, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the Fundamentals of Jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about, Ayatollah Sistani's fatwas about these issues that we are talking about, and in the previous episode, we started talking about kosher and the jurisprudential status of what a kosher is and what it is, in fact, to Muslims when it comes to eating. Would you tell our audience about the general status of the food which are in the non-Muslim countries, especially in the countries where there are lots of non-believers, you know, or disbelievers? So how can Muslims go about such food?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, we have to classify non-Muslims into two groups.
Mm-hmm.
One being the people of the book.
Yes.
And the other, the atheists, the pagans, the Buddhists, Sikhs, and these people who do not believe in an Abrahamic religion or in a divine religion.
Mm-hmm.
So Islam differentiates between these two categories of non-Muslims, okay? When it comes to the people of the book, they are ritually pure.
Yes.
And Muslims can easily interact with them. They can have give and take relationship with the people of the book. They are better known as Ahle Kitab, mm-hmm. okay?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, it's permissible to eat their food. It's permissible to eat from the same plate and to share your food with the people of the book.
Right.
They are not najis or ritually impure. So it's always easy to interact with Christians, with Jews, and with Zoroastrians, according to Ayatollah Sistani, because according to his eminence,
mm-hmm.
Zoroastrians are also the people of the book.
Mm-hmm.
They are followers of a divine religion.
Right.
But this is obviously contentious,
mm-hmm.
and many scholars and many Muslims have contradicted this issue. Or
yes.
This, yeah. Now, when it comes to the food served by Christians, of course we can eat the food given by them by the people of the book, and we do need to investigate whether the food is impure or not. As long as the food does not contain meat,
mm-hmm.
as long as the food does not contain any animal ingredients, we are allowed to eat that food.
By animal ingredient, you mean?
Okay, animal fat.
Uh-huh.
Animal fat is there. Of course, there are other ingredients which come originally from animals. And
what about eggs?
Eggs are halal, you know. If they come from chicken, they are halal.
Yeah, if they come from chicken, but, you know, lots of birds are not halal. So
you know,
if their eggs come to the market, then...
When we talk about eggs that come from chicken are easily, I think, you can
recognize them.
You can tell that these eggs are the eggs of a chicken, not of a crow or, let's say, an eagle or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So eggs are halal as long as you establish or as long as you're certain that the eggs come from a chicken,
mm-hmm.
see. But speaking about food, about meals in Western, in European or in American restaurants, of
mm-hmm.
course, because majority of the people there are Christians, it's not necessary to ask the individual who touches the food whether he is a Buddhist or a Christian. you can consider those non-Muslims as Christians, as people of the book, because the majority of the people there are people of the book. Mm-hmm. So basically, when you come across a non-Muslim person, it is not necessary to consider, it's not necessary to ask him whether he is a Christian or a Buddhist or a Sikh or someone, okay? You can treat him as
a member of the majority.
As a member of the majority. And therefore, it's not necessary to ask. This is the main issue to understand and to take notice of. And then the food that he gives you, if you are sure that the food has been touched by him, for example, if he brings you vegetable and he has washed the vegetable, or he has washed the dishes with naked hands,
mm-hmm.
Or he has touched the food in the state of wetness, the food is treated as halal, as permissible.
Even
if it's wet, of course. Yeah, because the people of the book are pure, ritually pure.
I see.
But it's necessary to make sure.
Okay. Let me actually take a break here, and then we'll be back and continue our discussion. Don't go away.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program, Islamic Law, on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our dear guest speaker. So, Sheikh Javid, you were speaking just before the break about, the people of the book are ritually pure, so whenever they touch the food, it doesn't make it actually contaminated, ritually speaking.
Yes.
So
yeah,
you were saying?
Course. There's no cross, there is a term used like cross contamination. That's what we are not talking about it. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Cross contamination can apply when, for example, the cook is cooking pork in one, cauldron, and then halal meat in another, and he is using the same spoon,
mm-hmm.
the same utensils, the same cutleries, and
right.
so on and so forth. This cross contamination is may occur.
Uh-huh, right.
But
sure.
we are not sure, and we are not duty bound. We are not obliged to investigate, to make sure whether cross contamination has occurred or
yes.
not. Of course, so you can eat the food served in American restaurants and European restaurants, provided that the food does not contain meat
mm-hmm.
and animal ingredients. That's
right.
for sure. When it comes to the countries with a majority Hindu population like India and many southeastern nations,
mm-hmm.
see, there are also Muslims living in those countries, of course, and those Muslims have greater problem
yes.
As compared to Muslims living in the West, because as a Muslim you are living in a Hindu majority community.
Right.
And you interact with them. Of course, interaction is something inevitable. You have to do business with them. You have to sell things to them and also buy things from
yes.
them. That's for sure. But when it comes to eating their food, Grand Ayatollah Sistani is of the opinion that as long as you do not know that the food is najis, is impure,
mm-hmm.
and insofar as the food does not contain, let's say, meat and these things, then
or the meat products,
it is permissible to eat the food,
right?
Because Muslims, Okay, for example, Muslims traveling from one province to another province, let's say a person, a Sunni Muslim, a Shia Muslim, travels from Bihar to Bombay in India.
Yes.
So he travels a long way. And he is of course he has to go to Bombay with few Muslim population. He cannot find any hotel, any restaurant. So what should he do? He should eat the food that he does not know that he doesn't know to be to be impure.
Yes.
So there's also something. There's also one important thing to note, and that is Hindus are ritually impure. Sikhs are ritually impure. If we know that they have touched something in the state of wetness, for example, with the, with his hand being wet, or with the object being wet, and the touching has taken place, we cannot use that thing,
whether
it's for prayer, whether it's for eating. For example, if the plate has been washed by a Hindu with an, with naked hand, you know, we cannot use it. And if the vegetable that you are going to eat is has been washed by a Hindu without using gloves, okay, you cannot eat that.
Or kitchen utensils.
Yeah, kitchen utensils. And there are Muslims living, having Hindu roommates.
Right.
Hindu roommates.
Mm-hmm.
They live in the same room. They use the same bathroom, the same, you see, washroom, you know.
Yes.
So they cannot... They cannot, you know, go against what they have seen, because when you see something, then that is definitely that brings you the certainty,
exactly,
and you cannot go against what you have seen.
Okay.
So things that are impure must be avoided.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. I hope you enjoyed this show, and you keep us in your du'as. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير
From the day he started his presidential campaign, U.S. President Joe Biden told the world that America wants to go back to Iran's nuclear deal. From that day, Israel started to threaten the world that if the U.S. goes back to the deal, it would take matters into its own hands. So as the talks continued between Tehran and the P4 plus one group of countries, Israel's voice of agony grows louder. Israel has launched a pressure campaign to make sure that the countries negotiating with Iran in Vienna do not agree to what Israeli officials call a bad deal, meaning a deal that allows Tehran to make nuclear bombs. The very idea of building a nuclear bomb is totally rejected by the Iranian government. In 2003, Iran's leader issued a fatwa that forbade the production and use of any form of weapon of mass destruction, which includes nuclear weapons. However, accusing Iran of going after the nukes is a strategy Israel uses to legitimize its hostile stance against Iran. The regime has even beefed up its military activities. In November, Israeli, Emirati, and Bahraini naval forces, for the first time, rehearsed joint security operations with a U.S. warship. A month earlier, Israel launched a war game at a desert airbase just north of the port city of Eilat, which sent fighter planes from the occupied territories and seven other countries roaring into the skies. Israel also allocated $1.5 billion to prepare the Israeli armed forces for a potential strike against Iran nuclear sites. In fact, there are near daily warnings from Israeli political and military officials as well. In the latest move in a series of threats, Israel's Minister of War Affairs ordered his forces to prepare a military option. Benny Gantz warned the world that Israel would take matters into its own hands if a nuclear agreement did not constrain Iran the way Israel wants it to.
Recently, the chief of staff, Aviv Kohavi, said that Israel is preparing to strike Iranian nuclear targets if needed. Are those preparations complete?
They will never complete. Before the only time of completing them will be the time that we will actually conduct them. Till then, we will continue to build them, to improve them. This is something that any military needs to do. We are working on it. We have them in our hands, of course, but we will continue and constantly improving them to the highest professional level possible. The Iranian nuclear aspiration must be stalled. If the world stops them before, it's very much good. But if not, we must stand independently and we must defend ourselves by ourselves.
What Gantz said could be interpreted as a direct threat. However, there are multiple military experts in and outside Israel who believe Gantz's statement was nothing but an empty threat. Several current and former senior Israeli military officials and experts say that Israel lacks the ability to attack Iran. Military experts say Tel Aviv can't pull off an assault that could destroy or even significantly delay Iran's nuclear program, at least not anytime soon. Now, one might ask why carrying out an assault on Iran would be impossible, given the fact that Israel has the latest military weaponry, fighter jets, and support of the United States. True, Israel has a long history when it comes to air attacks, but it won't be as easy as it was when it bombed Egypt, Gaza, Iraq, Lebanon, Sudan, Tunisia, and Syria. Not easy, at least, without potentially catastrophic consequences. To be sure, one could not compare Israel's bombing of such facilities in Iran to its air attacks against Iraq's Osirak reactor in 1981 or Syria's Al-Kubar facility in 2007. Relek Shafir, a retired Israeli Air Force general who was a pilot in a 1981 strike on an Iraqi nuclear facility, said, "Bombing Iran's nuclear facility is almost impossible." Iran has dozens of nuclear sites, some deep underground, that would be hard for Israeli bombs to quickly penetrate and destroy. The fact is, the Israeli Air Force does not have warplanes large enough to carry such large bombs, so the more protected sites would have to be struck repeatedly with less effective missiles, a process that might take days or even weeks. The other obstacle is geography. If Israel decides to carry out strikes on Iran, its warplanes must fly over 3,000 kilometers to get to Iran. This would cause fuel shortages as the planes have to fly the same amount to go back to Israel. Israel has already ordered jets that can make such flights at a cost of $2.4 billion, but the aircraft are backordered and Israel is unlikely to receive even one before late 2024. There's also the fear of retaliation. Naturally, if Iran gets attacked, it will respond vehemently. Some Israeli planes would almost certainly be lost during the sorties. Their pilots would be killed or taken prisoner, and such losses would have huge consequences for Israel. Let's not forget that Iran is a country of nearly 86 million people, with the potential ability to mobilize its networks all over the Middle East to retaliate. From Lebanon to Palestine and Syria, pro-Iranian forces surrounding Israel could make the regime pay a huge price for any attack. Israel's famous missile system is no good for such a confrontation either. The Iron Dome was never tested in a real battle. It only intercepted man-made Gazan rockets, not real missiles or rockets. It's not even capable of intercepting those handcrafted missiles coming from Gaza. So, if a war erupts, it is safe to say that the Iron Dome can't be much of a help to Israelis. In the meantime, Iran has a formidable missile arsenal of its own capable of precision strikes, which can easily respond to an Israeli bombing of its nuclear sites by going after softer targets.
They always shoot at Israel rockets, but in 2004 or 5, people start to get killed. Make me very annoyed that we don't have a solution. And also, I remember even 91, when Iraq shoot missiles in Israel, we have no solution. You know, everything was, Tel Aviv was empty, okay. They shoot around Tel Aviv. And I decided that we have to do something. Although nothing had been done around the world and everybody said it cannot be done.
One doesn't need to be a general or a strategist to find out that the declarations by the Israeli officials about Israel's readiness for a military strike are empty and pointless rhetoric. All you need is to look at the past few decades. Since January 1995, Israel has been saying that Iran is much closer to producing nuclear weapons than previously thought and could be less than 5 years away from having an atomic bomb. 27 years later, Israel continues threatening to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities. And yet nothing, it's quite clear. Israel is just playing pretend.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.